Happy Friday, everyone. This is Pam Stack, your host, and you're listening to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. This fine evening, I am so honored to have with me a very distinguished author. William Martin has written, he is a New York Times bestselling author and an award winner. He's written 10 novels. He's written a PBS documentary. He does book reviews, magazine articles. He even has a cult classic horror film. I can't wait to talk about that. He is such a unique writer that he blends today with the past. Most of his books are all about military and historical. His page is absolutely beautiful. I hope you get a chance to go over and visit it at williammartinbooks.com. In the meantime, my guest this evening, Bill Martin. Bill, welcome to Authors on the Air. Thank you so much for being here.
Pam Stack, it's good to be on with you.
Thank you. We're usually talking in Messenger instead of talking on the radio. I'm delighted that you're here. You've classed me up a whole lot tonight. You know, usually it's Funny Farm here.
Well,
now I feel
that's
like
a
NPR.
Nice compliment.
You've given the show a little bit of class. It won't last long, but thank you for
doing it anyway. I read your post today on social media where you said that the show is usually a Funny Farm.
Funny Farm, and I said,
well, just call me Rodney Dangerfield.
Okay, there you go.
If you'd like.
I'm telling you, honestly, I love every single one of my guests. We have the best time. But sometimes, you know, of your stature comes on the show, and you've written so many important books. I know they're fiction, but they're so important, and you're involved in so many important things that I feel like I should not wear pajamas for this or something, you know, and actually instead of slurping a Coke or an iced tea, I should be, you know, daintily holding a brandy snifter or something. I don't know. But I'm glad you're here
brandy,
regardless.
It could be a nice glass of Cabernet. I'm currently researching a novel that's all about the gold rush, but it's also about the modern wine-growing business in California. So Cabernets and Zinfandels are my drinks of choice right now.
Oh, I like cabs. But, you know, I'm real fond of also is the Tempranillas and the Riojas from Spain.
Yeah.
I like those.
Yep.
I like those very
yep.
much. Very rich and full-bodied, so delightful. I want to talk about your books, but tell me more about Cabernet. That you said that's your drink of choice. Your wine of choice.
Yeah.
You started to tell me?
Well, right now, what I'm focused more on drinking Zinfandels because Zinfandels grow in the area of California where the gold rush exploded in 1849. And some guys
didn't really
make them. Yeah, up in the Amador County, up in those hills. And some of the oldest Zinfandel vines were planted up there because the thing about the gold rush that I write about in this novel is that everybody figures out that they can't really get rich quick, but they may have brought a skill to California that they had in wherever it was they were originally from. And there were winemakers. The first winemakers came to satisfy the market here. A lot of big spending, big drinkers who came to California and found gold and were happy to spend it to get a good glass of wine or champagne or brandy or whatever else. So it's been a lot of fun doing the research on this book. And
I don't know why I was under the impression that Zinfandels were a fairly new trend in wine. I did not realize that they had been around for so long. I didn't know that. Fascinating.
More than Cabernet, actually. They are the American grape. They are the first American grape, I think, because they were brought from Eastern. Some people think Eastern Europe, some people think Sicily, but they ended up here in California. And I'm writing about them, and I'm saying here in California, even though I'm from Boston, I'm out here doing research. So the opportunity to visit my sons is also part of this program. And once this show is over, I'll be drinking with my sons, whom I don't see anywhere near often enough.
I bet not. Now, are either or both of your sons creatives also?
One of them is. Well, they both are in a way. One of them is probably doing creative work that we'll all benefit from. He's in pharmaceutical venture capital, so they're always trying to find the next drug that will improve people's lives. And my other son is one of the top game writers in California. He worked for Telltale Games. He wrote episode 3 of the game version of Game of Thrones, and he's working now on another one of their big projects.
Wow!
Yeah.
Wow!
So he, you know, my son said to me after he graduated from college what I had said to my father. Way back in 1972, I said to my father, "Dad, I want to go to film school." And he said, "Film school? I'd really rather see you go to law school. But if you don't do what you want to do when you're young, you'll spend the rest of your life looking over your shoulder." And so when my son graduated from college and said, "Dad, I want to go to film school," I said the same thing. And I said, "Well, but what your grandfather said to me is probably the best advice." And as he's been in California and Hollywood writing screenplays and so forth, you know, I've watched his efforts to get his career started. And I said to him, "You know, you should try to do what I ended up doing. If you can't get in the front door of this movie business, go around and kick in the window. Find a different way in, because what you want to do is tell stories." And that was what I wanted to do. And when I couldn't sell my screenplays, I said, "I'll write a novel." And I wrote a novel, and the first novel, which was called Back Bay, spent 14 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And I was only 29 when it came out, and it meant I never had to have a real job again. And he has now broken into this game business at a very high level. And this is the first new narrative form of entertainment in 100 years since the movies. The revenues in the game business outstrip the movies. And, of course, they outstrip publishing, too.
There is one thing I always look at, and that's in my news feeds, and that's in science and technology. And there is always something new being introduced into that market because television, or let me clarify, cable television is gone. We're now looking at streaming, something on your internet. So, you know, I think that classic television is not going to be there a whole lot longer, or they're going to struggle. As it is, they struggle right now. But in gaming, there is always something new, and I think that's why Comic-Con is so important and grows larger and larger every year. I want to talk a little bit about you some more because you have some very interesting background history that I'd love to discuss. Not only are you from Boston, but you have your BA from Harvard. You parked the car in the Harvard yard and put a quad
That's
in
right.
Anita, didn't you? I know that because my parents were from Worcester, although my brothers and I were all born in Miami. How did you enjoy going to Harvard? And did you feel like you got your, or did your parents feel like they got your education because you got your BA in English? Interesting.
I went to Harvard during the years when the student rebellion was unfolding. The real intense years from 68 to 72. And so in a lot of ways, my education got somewhat truncated because 2 years ended without exams or anything else. And yet it was quite a satisfying place to have gone in the 60s or in the 70s or at any other time. And the truth about Harvard was that it was as much about the people that you met as it was and met over the dinner tables in the dining halls as it was about the classes or anything else, even though those were important as well. The other night I had dinner in a restaurant in Knob Hill in San Francisco with the man who was my tutor 40 years ago at Harvard, who's now Harvard's greatest living historian. His name is, or California's greatest living historian, excuse me. His name is Kevin Starr, and we were reminiscing about Harvard, and it was a great it was a great time to be there because I actually got material out of living at Harvard in the 1960s that I put into one of my novels. It's the only historical novel in which I actually had some history that I had lived through, and that was the bust and the takeover of University Hall, and then the bust at University Hall, all of which I saw, I put into the book Harvard Yard, which came out in 2003. So, you know, it's like anything else. Your education is going to be generated by your own intellectual curiosity and your own drive. And I always told my kids that when they were applying to college. And wherever they got in would be it would be upon them to take advantage of what that institution had to offer, and not the other way around, you know.
Well, that's true.
Self-reliance is important.
I think so. And, you know, it's interesting to me because being in Boston, going to Harvard, not only are you were given the opportunity to learn from one of the best institutions in the country, but you are surrounded by history. And as such, it does not surprise me that you are not only, you know, deeply ensconced in that, but you also are very involved in a lot of the old landmarks there. You're with the Massachusetts Historical Society, the Colonial Society of Massachusetts. You're with the Paul Revere Memorial Association and the Bostonian Society. You're a trustee of the USS Constitution Museum. Are you still on the board of directors of the Associates of the Boston Public Library? I'm assuming
I'm on the board of an organization that raises funds for the library to support, preserve, and digitize the Boston Public Library's rare books and special collections. We're called the Associates of the BPL. And we provide money to attract assistance and attention to one of the great resources in America, the special collections of the Boston Public Library, Shakespeare first folios, books printed 800 years ago, the 20th Regiment collection, which is an incredible collection of Civil War material, which I used when I was writing the Lincoln Letter. You know, an extraordinary resource for scholars. And in the modern public library, it's a very difficult thing for the politicians to get their mind around how important all of this stuff is. And
yes, I know that well.
It's part of our cultural patrimony, and people have to understand that. You know, if we don't recognize, appreciate, and honor where we came from as a culture and a society, how can we continue to advance into the future with any kind of confidence and surety about who we are? And that's why,
I've
written.
It's so fascinating to me that there is that rich history in the Northeast, yet I grew up in Miami, and they want to shutter libraries to save money and put it into other projects. And it makes me crazy because libraries, to me, growing up, were essential to my life. And after I found myself as a divorced woman with not working and no transportation, I could walk to the brand new library where I live down in Southwest Florida. I could walk there and go with my shopping basket and bring home 50 books a month, and I would be in heaven. I also want to mention that you are an acquaintance of, or perhaps a friend with, one of the best, I think, historians in the country, David McCullough. I was so impressed when I saw that. There is not one book he's written that I haven't read and been astounded by. And I have to tell you, it is just generally not my genre to read him. I'm very much a genre fiction reader, but I think that you seem to be cut from the same mold. Although he is writing nonfiction, you are writing fiction, but I can see a friendship between you two. Whether it's there or not, it makes sense to me.
Well, he's a very nice man, and I always enjoy seeing him around town. He lives in Boston, you know, he's a big supporter of our efforts with the Associates of Boston Public Library. In fact, he lent his name to one of the funds that we use to provide help for the library. He's a cheerful, friendly guy, and you would enjoy meeting him and being in his presence. We first bonded over our book covers. You posted earlier today three of the book covers from Cape Cod, Back Bay, and Harvard Yard, all of which were done by the artist Wendell Miner, probably the greatest cover artist of his generation. And David insists, it's in his contract, that Wendell Miner is the only person who will do his book covers, who will design them, who will either paint the cover as he did with Truman, or use one of the Gilbert Stuart paintings as he did with the John Adams book. And so that's how David and I became friends, was through Wendell Miner. And we remain friends. In fact, I just saw David at an event at the Old South Meeting House in Boston about 3 weeks ago, and I was telling him all about my Gold Rush book. He says, "Oh, I can't wait to read it." So you'll be getting a copy of it very soon. And you know,
there you
before
go.
Before David wrote 1776, I was having dinner with him one night, and we were talking about George Washington because, of course, I had done an episode of The American Experience back when David was on the show. I had written and narrated and actually appeared in this film about George Washington. And he said, "You know, Bill, there's a great novel in the life of George Washington." And that kind of put me on the path to writing Citizen Washington, which came out in 1999.
Oh, fabulous.
Wonderful. It didn't sell as well as his book 1776, but you know, I'll take what I can get.
There you go. Well, it's interesting to me that not only did you not stay in Boston for your graduate degree, you went clear across country to get your MFA from the University of Southern California for motion picture production, and I was reading that you really were frustrated because no one would buy all of your screenplays. And that's how you ended up writing your first novel. But let me ask you this. I have spoken to many authors who have been screenwriters, and they swear that that is one of the best ways to learn how to write a fiction novel. Do you agree with that? Tell me why.
You know, when I was younger, I sure did. I think I might feel a little bit differently now, but when I was younger, I came at the process in the way that a screenwriter comes at the process. What's the big plot element? What drives this whole bus? You know, how can I keep them turning pages? And when you write screenplays, you're always aware of the fact that you're writing, as the cynics always say, you're writing screenplays. That means you're writing for people who don't like to read. But as you get older and you begin to understand what the process of writing a novel is all about, you begin to try to work the development of the story from a little bit different angle, through the characters rather than through that fast-moving plot. I still like to write novels with fast-moving plots. I think that's important.
Sure.
I think narrative, the thing that you learn that you never forget as a screenwriter is that narrative thrust means everything. You need to keep people turning pages. You need to give them a reason to come back to your book in particularly the environment that we inhabit today, with so many different things that will distract a person in an instant. From Facebook to, a big screen TV down in the living room. And you really need to have that sense of narrative thrust. And that's the thing you learn as a screenwriter. If you're not pushing every scene forward, so that the viewer really has a sense that they're getting somewhere.
Right.
You're going to fail. And
you know, I'm glad you're saying that, Bill, because
mm-hmm.
as a reader, now I isolate myself completely when I'm reading. I don't own a television, so I'm happy about that. I have no problem staying away, you know, from a television. But what happens to, and I don't care how long a book is, and I don't care what the format is. To me, it's not the format, it's the content. Whether I'm on my Kindle or if I have, like I do in my hands right now, your paper books. I don't like it when I get into a story and I'm about a third of the way through, and then I'm saying, okay, let me see if I can skip forward here to about two thirds.
Yeah.
Because I want to know where that story arc is, and if you're taking me on a ride and you're supposed to have a thriller there, or actually it could be any genre of book.
Yep.
Don't make me fall asleep and say, oh, we'll finish this some other time. You know, I read a lot of books. I have a lot of books come across my desk, and I'm going to take a look at the book, and I'm going to say, this is what I want to read. And I hope it holds my interest the whole way through. I will tell you, as an avid reader of about 400 books a year, that the past 3 years, I've read some of the best fiction ever.
Yeah.
That a lot of the newer writers that coming into the business have done a remarkable job. My absolute favorite guy of all time, Jeffrey Deaver, says every time he comes here, he says, economy of words. You have to use an economy of words. You got to push that story. You got to push that story. So, you know, you get to the end of the chapter and I'm hanging on for dear life. Now, that's the kind of book I want to read, regardless of the genre. So you were writing these screenplays and scripts, and nothing was happening, and you said, screw it, I'm going to write a book.
Yeah.
Your book turned out to be a hugely successful book.
Yep.
Did you know then that you understood what the craft was, or is this something you have to work at continually? Do you ever truly learn the craft of writing, no matter how many books you write?
Well, I like to say now that it never gets easier, but you may get better at it. And I still feel that I'm getting better at it from book to book. But with Back Bay, I walked in basically not knowing anything except narrative thrust and how to construct a plot, and I didn't really even have a fully clarified understanding of how to sustain multiple points of view. And yet I wrote a book that people are still reading 35 years, almost 40 years later. And I think that the process is whenever you sit down to do this, you bring a lot of talent to it. If you're going to be successful at it, you have learned, you have studied, and yet you have something that other people just don't have. Whatever that instinct is, that what I sometimes call it the third eye, the ability to tell that story in a way that nobody else has ever told it. I kind of like that to sports. I could teach someone how to shoot a free throw on a basketball court. I used to coach the little kids, you know. But I can't teach them how to see the court the way that Larry Bird or Magic Johnson or one of the great basketball players can, because that's a God-given talent. And I do believe that you have to have a certain level of God-given talent that is then underlaid with the training, with the reading that you've done, you know. And naturally, everyone preaches. It's one of Stephen King's most pronounced comments. If you want to be a writer, do a lot of reading. Read the authors that you like. Absorb from them. Learn their not their tricks, but their techniques. And I agree with that. And then perhaps once you've studied and learned and maybe gone to a few workshops, that natural talent might just blossom for you, as it did for me when I was very young, and which I still am working to hone and understand now when I'm not very young.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because I think a lot of authors, especially young guys, are thinking, oh, God, you know, it gets so much harder. I've got book one out, and now I got to do book two, and it seems so much more difficult than doing the first book. And I guess it is. I suppose that if you've had good success with your first book, you have a lot to live up to. I'm not a writer, so I don't know that, but I would assume that's the way it is. I want to talk specifically now about the Peter Fallon novels. Could you give listeners a little background information on who Peter Fallon and Evangeline Carrington are?
Well, they appeared in Back Bay. That was the first novel that they showed up in. I had an idea with Back Bay. I was going to write a novel about Paul Revere treasure buried in the landfill under the streets of Boston, and I was going to use the geography of the city as one of the plot elements, because the city was, at one time, it was much smaller, and they poured lots of landfill and created the Back Bay and so forth. And I wanted to have a historical plot running in tandem with a modern treasure hunt. And the modern treasure hunt included this young Harvard graduate student whose father had been disappointed that he didn't go to law school, a young Harvard graduate student who gets involved in the search for this lost Revere tea set. And so Back Bay was the first novel in which Peter Fallon appeared. He meets Evangeline Carrington, who is part of the family that he's researching at the time. And the story ends, and I didn't think I would ever revisit them. And then 20 years later, I was thinking, maybe I should write a book about Harvard. I had already written one about another famous American educational institution called Annapolis.
Annapolis.
And that book had done quite well. And it's probably the only single-volume novel that covers the whole history of a branch of the United States military from pirates on the Chesapeake in 1715 all the way up to the Gulf War. So I said, I'll do one about Harvard. And that was when I decided that I would bring Peter Fallon back. And once I brought him back as a mature adult who's a dealer in rare books and documents, as an ex-wife says of him, he's Indiana Jones in a monogram shirt, I said, I think I have something here that I might stay with for a few more books. And so I wrote another book after Harvard Yard. I wrote a book called The Lost Constitution with Peter and Evangeline in that one. And that became a New York Times bestseller. And my editors and publishers said, we want more Peter Fallon, even though I was thinking of trying something else. So since then, I've written two more Peter Fallons, and there's another one coming early next year, I hope. And that's the one that I'm working on now about the gold rush. But Peter provides me the opportunity to do an extensive historical novel while at the same time giving you a modern suspense tale to keep you turning pages, and also to remind you that the history matters, that the places that Peter takes you in his search for, well, a lost Paul Revere tea set in Back Bay, a lost Shakespeare manuscript in Harvard Yard, the lost Lincoln diary in the Lincoln letter, the places he takes you when he searches for those things are places that still matter to us for the events that unfolded in those places. And readers that really like the novels will always tell me that what they like is that sense of bringing the history to life, not only for the reader of historical fiction, but also for the person who's sitting back saying, I don't really care too much about history. Well, no, wait. When Peter Fallon gets involved, suddenly you see the connections between the past and the present. And that's what I'm all about in these books.
I want to take a break right now and remind everyone, this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Austin on the Air Global Radio Network. The delightful and distinguished William Martin. Bill is here talking about not only history, but thrillers. And although his books are very modern, some start from a long time ago and come forward. If you'd like to call in and say hello and ask questions of New York Times bestselling author William Martin, please do. The number is 347-633-9609. I want to talk to you about Annapolis, because when you mentioned that book, I also know that Publishers Weekly described you as being the maritime James Michener. I had the honor and privilege of meeting him when I was, I think, 18 or 19 years old. He was an amazing man, and so gentle and so kind and so quiet. And I thought, I have met with greatness. And you must have felt pretty over the moon by that description from Publishers Weekly.
Oh, yes. I was very honored by that. You know, Michener had a career that spanned five decades. He was writing massive tomes and hugely popular books well into his 80s. And while I don't suspect that I will have his, or I know I won't have his sales success dream of having his longevity and the success of continuing to publish long after retirement age has been passed. And I think
what an amazing thing to be compared to. You know, if you put your pen down and never wrote again, that is such, I wouldn't even know, you know, I don't even know how to express how important that is. And
well,
that says a lot about you.
I learned a lot from him, from the books of his that I read, and in a way copied his style in books like Cape Cod and Annapolis, where I basically began at the beginning and took you through to the end. You know, that's what he does in Chesapeake or Hawaii.
These
enormously ambitious in his effort to tell you the story of a place. And I liked that ambition, and I guess I kind of embraced it myself. But what I always tried to do that he didn't really care quite as much about was to have an overarching plot that holds the whole thing together. You know, in Cape Cod, that novel begins with a whale stranding in 1000 A.D. And somehow or another, that whale stranding in 1000 A.D. has some impact on the characters of today. And Michener didn't quite tighten his plots like that across seven or eight hundred pages.
No, they were.
He was more about individual arcs, individual groups of characters, and he knew how to do it. So
he sure did.
A kind
and gentle man, and that's a wonderful thing. I want to kind of skip around a little bit, because you have so many interesting things that you've done in your life, and you've also created an award-winning documentary for PBS. Can you tell me what that documentary was about, please?
George Washington. It was the American Experience episode called George Washington, the Man Who Wouldn't Be King. And it came out in the early 90s, and a good friend of mine was asked if he'd like to direct the film, that they were looking for somebody to animate paintings, because that's the only visual material you have for the 18th century. Could you animate these paintings in the way that Ken Burns has just done it with photographs in the Civil War?
Right.
Yeah, and he said to me, I don't suppose you would write this. And I said, I'll write it if I get to narrate it. Point, I thought to myself, geez, maybe I could be the road company David McCullough. I spent quite some time on that film and had a wonderful time working on it. And we went on locations to all of the battlefields where Washington had fought and made his fame. And then we shot in the State House at Annapolis because that's where Washington truly makes his historical fame, when he hands the army over to civilian authority, establishing one of the most important concepts in American life, that the military is subservient to civilian authority. And the film won the best video from the Chicago Film and Video Festival for 1991-92, and won a few other awards. And I was very proud of it. We've often talked of going back and making another one, another American Experience, that director and I, but the opportunity has just never arisen.
Interesting.
You
would do it in a heartbeat, though, wouldn't you?
Huh?
Yeah. You would do it in a heartbeat, though, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would, yeah. We once talked about doing one about John Wayne and John Ford, movie director, and, of course, John Wayne. And it was right around that time that they popped up with a film about John Wayne and John Ford. And so I missed that opportunity. And then American history is so full of wonderful material that you can make a film about or write a book about. And if it's done in a way that is accessible to readers, tell them a story. And this is something that McCullough is always preaching. I am just a storyteller. You know, and in a way, that's how I feel about myself, that I am really just a storyteller. And if I can't be
But that is how authors, writers are storytellers. I absolutely agree with you. I think that's a wonderful way to describe yourself. I've always thought that. You know, I was just speaking to someone last week about this. You know, the South has a rich tradition of storytelling. That's the, you know, familial history, generation information was handed down through storytelling at gatherings. You know, you wrote births and deaths in a Bible, and you told stories for entertainment and all. So it doesn't surprise me that you feel like that, and that's as it should be. I'm curious, though, because of the nature of how in-depth you are with all of your books, your research is critical to what you do. While most authors say Google is an author's best friend now, you prefer to be on site as much as you
can. Walk the ground.
I want to tell you, John Irving says that when he goes on vacation, that he walks in the footsteps of his characters. I thought that was the most amazing thing I had ever heard an author say, that he went to Vietnam because he wanted to, I guess his wife and somebody else wanted to go to Vietnam to visit family and friends and everything else. And he said for him, it was a walk in his character's footsteps. That's a brilliant thing to hear. You know, it's remarkable. You cannot possibly get the same feeling for history by Googling it and by reading other books. You must have to be on location. Am I right about that?
You are absolutely right about that. Even if everything around you has changed when you're writing a historical novel, if you can stand in the place that you've written about and just see the fall of the light and feel the gust of the wind, you'll understand something about your characters. I was doing that today in San Francisco, standing at a place where the ships all anchored in the gold rush. There are famous photographs of these ships because they were all abandoned. They sailed around the Horn, and then the crews all deserted and went up into the hills to look for gold. And so I was doing it today, and I wanted to have a scene in the cable car museum. So I was there today as well. And
feel it at a cellular level, though. You must cellular level when you are there walking where your characters walked or what yep. used to be the place where their characters walked. You have to feel it. If you love it that much, you have to feel it.
And that's the thing that, getting back to what you were saying earlier, that's the thing that happens in a city like Boston, even
yes.
when you're not aware of it, you know. When you walk past imagine. The old State House where the Declaration of Independence was first read to the people of New England, or you walk past the old South Meeting House where I just happened to see David McCullough a few weeks ago, that,
right.
of course, was the place where Samuel Adams started the Boston Tea Party, which finally kicked the British into high dudgeon over what was going on in America. You know, you go to those places, you walk by them, they become part of the fabric of your existence, and you really do begin to feel history on a cellular level. When I wrote the Lincoln Letter, I spent a lot of time in Ford's Theater. You know, the climax is in Ford's
yes.
Theater. I don't want to give anything away by telling you that Booth gets him in the end, but, you know,
right.
there's a secondary plot unfolding
right.
as well.
Right.
And
right.
I went to all the battlefields. I've been to Gettysburg, naturally, many times, but the 20th Regiment of Massachusetts, that's the regiment in the book, they were at a certain spot at Gettysburg on the third day, and I stood there just to see what it would have felt like. And that's, in a way, it's fun tourism, but it's so much more than that. And I'll never stop doing what I do, because I can always travel and have this great sense of wonder at the things that I see, and, oh, I have to write about that. I have to write about that, you know. We just came back from a European trip, and it was one of those Rhine cruises, and seeing the Cologne
yes.
Cathedral or the bridge too far, you know, those
yes.
things just fire your imagination, you know.
I would imagine.
I'm not,
yeah,
I hope I keep writing, but I'm in awe of listening to you.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I hope I keep writing, but sometimes I think I have so many ideas that I'd like to write that I may run out of time. I don't know.
Well, I don't think you will, but that's a really good point. You know, I try to ask this of all of my guests because it's important. I want to know, how do you know with all of those ideas, and particularly because you walked Earth in a very different way than other people walk it. You walk it with a sense of how it used to be and how it's changed to become what it is. So bearing
yeah.
that in mind, which is a very unique gift, I'm in awe of it, and I'm envious of it that I don't have the knowledge that you do, but I recognize what you're saying. I do. I understand it. How do you know which idea that you were just talking about, how do
yeah.
you know which one is going to stick with you and that's the one you write about? How does it happen?
Well, let's start at the business level. You may have a
okay.
couple of ideas that you're interested in, and the best place to test them out is with your agent and with your editor and publisher. Which one of these do you think the readers out there would be most interested in? And which one of these do you think the book buyers of today, the buyers for Barnes & Noble and the independent bookstores,
right. Right, right.
You know, you do have to think at some level as a businessman when you're going to sustain a career as I have across now almost 40 years doing this, 40
mm-hmm.
years in which I've only written, 11 novels. So I'm not one of those guys that produces them really quickly, and like a lot of my friends are, a lot of people that you and I both know. And
right.
And so there is a certain degree of analysis that I fall back upon my editors and publishers to provide for me. But at the same time, there's always something that you say, I've always wanted to write about that. I had always wanted to write a novel that took you from the beginning of the Civil War to the end of the Civil War. And in
wow.
conversation with my editor, he kept saying to me, you know, there's a great novel about the Emancipation Proclamation. And I thought to myself, well, he likes the Emancipation Proclamation, and I want to do the whole Civil War, so now is the time to do them both together. And that's what I did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's fabulous. Now, I have kind of an offbeat question, but you have an offbeat answer.
Yeah.
You wrote a movie that was a horror movie. A cult.
Yes, I did.
Horror movie. And while I know that you have written across many, many genres here, you're kind of not your normal writer because you've written so many different things. What in the world did you do that you wrote something called The Humanoids from the Deep? It was Roger Corman's cult classic.
Yep.
I am fascinated by it. Please tell me.
And
with Doug McClure, of all people.
Doug McClure, Vic Morrow, you remember him?
Yes.
Yeah, he was in it too. Yeah.
He died in
a
filming something, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
oh my God.
That's
so funny. It's so funny.
Well,
tell
I
me the story.
On those years as when I was in Hollywood having the opportunity to go to Roger Corman's College of B-Movie Knowledge. You know, don't forget that Corman in the 70s, 60s and 70s was giving everybody a shot, the people
yes.
with talent. And almost all
yes.
of them worked for him. Peter Bogdanovich, Martin Scorsese, Jack Nicholson,
right.
Francis Ford Coppola, on and on and on. So I made a connection at his studio through an instructor of mine who had written Death Race 2000 for them
mm-hmm.
with Keith Carradine. And so when she called me up one day, just after I had finished writing Back Bay, and she said, we have an assignment for you, I was not going to turn that one down, because how many screenplays had I written at that point? I think 3 or 4 that nobody wanted to produce. And so didn't matter what it was. And it was called Humanoids from the Deep. All they had was the title, and they had some money that had been brought to them by a California real estate guy that wanted to get into the movies. And I think that was why the movie got started. And he said, I want to do another version of Creature from the Black Lagoon. And so they gave me the opportunity to write it. And you know that movie, I was reading this recently, was the second highest grossing movie of the summer of 1980. The first highest grossing was The Empire Strikes Back. So maybe I should have stayed out there writing horror movies, but
you and I wouldn't be talking. We wouldn't be talking then. I can't do horror at all. I can't even do Vincent Price movies, truly. I'm a scaredy cat on that stuff. There are times when I'm like, I have to grab a cat and go under the covers and read under there when I'm reading, a really tight thriller. It scares crap
yeah.
out of me. I easily scare on things like that. But listen, the Corman films are very popular now. They're hugely
yeah.
popular.
Yeah. The first time that I met Stephen King was at a party for somebody you might remember, Robert B. Parker. Who
yes.
wrote the Spencer novels.
Of course.
And so this was an early
wow.
party for Parker, and Stephen King was there, and somebody introduced me to King as the man who had written Humanoids from the Deep, which had just come out. And Stephen King lit up like a Christmas tree. He loved that stuff. But you know what was more amazing? Somebody said to him, well, I've also written a novel called Back Bay, and he had read it. He knew the plot, he remembered it, and that was one of the things that struck me later on when I was reading King's book on writing, and he talked about, as I just said a little bit earlier, how you have to read in order to be
yeah.
a good writer.
Right.
A voracious reader, Stephen King. But he liked
yeah.
Humanoids from the Deep. So
many
people
that.
Many
what a
people
great
have
story.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a fabulous story,
exactly,
Bill.
Not, huh? Sorry,
it's a fabulous story.
Yeah. Well, Humanoids from the Deep has given me a lot of mileage, a lot of stories that I can tell about the experience of working on that movie, and I learned a lot from it too, as you always do whenever you write anything.
Well, I have to tell you, that's a good reason for you to come back to the show again. I want to spend the next hour and a half talking to you, but I know I told you I wouldn't take up all this time, and I have taken up so much of your time already. I cannot tell you.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, it's been a joy for me. I get goosebumps thinking about, now I'm going to think about every time I go out and walk outside, no matter where I am, wherever I am in a conference, I have to go and walk outside and get that cellular feeling that we talked about.
Yep.
Because I think every place has a little bit of history, even the young places like, you know, here I am in Florida. We have a nice little history, but it's not nearly as rich yet as places like Boston and San Francisco and all. But we're getting there. We're making it our own,
yeah,
you know.
Well,
so
you have to come back.
Please come back.
I would love to.
Tell everybody where they can find you on the interwebs, please.
You can find me on williammartinbooks.com. And you can also find me on Facebook at william.martin.author. So both places.
And Bill will answer you back. He's very, very kind about that. He's not one of those authors who has somebody else answer his stuff. So,
I enjoy talking to people.
I know you do. And this has been a glorious conversation for me. Really, it's a high for me. And it's one that goes down in the history books. Thank you very much for the signed books. I'm very honored. They will go with me. My brother said, what the hell are you going to do with all those books? And I said, well, most of them are signed. And he said, yeah, but you have crates of them in the attic. And I said, that's because they're laid between non-acid tissue paper and wrapped carefully and then put in, you know, special storage containers. And he said, what are you going to do? You know, when you kick the bucket, who's going to want your books? I said, oh, you don't understand. I don't care what happens. You put me and my books in the crematory, and whether I'm going north or south, I'm going to have something to read. That's all there is to it. So that's what the deal is. Yours will be a welcome addition to my most treasured library, and I can't thank you enough, author William Martin, New York Times bestselling author of 11 beautiful books. Please come back again. We have so many more things to talk about.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful weekend.
Kim.
Enjoy being with your family. And thank you again for being here. Good night.
Good night.
What an amazing show. Thank you so much for being with me. You've got to try one of William Martin's books. They're fantastic. Have a joyful weekend. Be kind. Pay it forward. Thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.